Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. Ontario Health Minister Christine Elliott unveiled the outline of changes to the healthcare system. The overhaul will include a new super agency called Ontario Health that will absorb the local health integration networks, or LHINs. As you might already know, it oversees all hospitals, home care, and waiting lists for nursing homes. It will also take over the provincial agencies that look after cancer and organ transplants. The big idea being suggested at this time is to take all the various providers, the hospitals, long-term care, nursing homes, community health clinics, and family doctors, and create one team. The government says most Ontario health teams will form locally, covering a geographic population of no more than 300,000 people. But some teams will be formed to serve a group of patients with specific care needs, for instance, mental health. We have seen this already happening in Northumberland with the recent announcement around the partnerships for youth mental health drop-in clinics, and along with the joint counseling services with Northumberland Counseling Services and the Extendicare partnership. My guest today has his own ideas around what needs to happen to improve the system. Steve Skivington is an author, journalist, and political pundit. He recently released a book called This May Hurt a Bit, Reinventing Canada's Healthcare System. It provides insight and a list of suggestions he thinks will make it better. Welcome, Stephen.
Hi, how are you?
Good. How are you?
I am very good.
Now, if you were a doctor, what prescription would you give to the Ontario government to heal the current system?
Well, I watched with great interest their latest announcement, the super agency, and I may be one of the few people in the province who think it didn't go far enough. Having written the book, the parallels between the Harris government back in 96 and the Ford government today are remarkable. And in the same way, Mike Harris, with his Healthcare Restructuring Act, didn't go far enough and take advantage of the fact he had a huge mandate. They'd won a 45% of the election. As it turns out, they would win next election the same amount, 45%. And I just think that there's nobody really that I can see is gonna steal the next election from Doug Ford. So I personally would have gone further and looked at medical tourism, the hybrid system, the mix of private and public, medical savings accounts, all of the kinds of things I talk about in my book, I think should be here. So it's a good first start, but if this is the whole shebang, it's really disappointing.
Well, then we've seen doctors write books about what needs to be done to our healthcare system, but you're not a doctor or a nurse, and by your own admission in the book, you question your own credentials. So what qualifies you to offer this vision of healthcare then?
Yeah, some people say I should have an SD behind my name for spin doctor, but I basically say I'm like the everyman. If any Canadian had been parachuted behind enemy lines 25, 30 years ago, and got to witness all the things I've got to witness as an ordinary Canadian, and now I've come back like a war correspondent or the canary in a coal mine, if you want to think of it that way, to report on what I've seen. So, I used to laugh about when I was writing my articles, some people used to say it was like watching a guy walk between two buildings on a high wire, and halfway through the article, you weren't sure I was going to make it to the other side. So in this case, this book, because I'm not a journalist, is very much written like a novel in the same way that my columns were very much like short stories. And so it's a funny book. It's full of entertaining stories. It's full of my experience with my family and our healthcare system. It's, of course, a lot of backroom stuff, a lot of war stories that as a lobbyist I've been able to do to witness. And in particular, I've always loved novels. And it's written very much like a novel. I've always loved novels where a guy goes into a bar and starts telling his life story to a stranger. So in this case, I take that most Canadian thing, a walk through the woods. So we're taking a walk through the woods, and instead of telling my story, I'm telling the story of healthcare, the history of healthcare, how we got where we are, and ultimately what we might do to fix it.
But ultimately, you are a political pundit, but you're also, you worked for a very long time for the Ontario Medical Association. Can you tell us a bit about what you did there?
Yeah, I was basically their lobbyist. I was their government relations manager. And you know, we would go up to Queen's Park, talk to MPPs and ministers, members of the opposition, members of the government. We would attend fundraisers. We would attend policy conventions, really the whole thing. And we took it even further because not only did I have over 1,000 doctors who we trained how to lobby, we even trained doctors, spouses, and siblings how to run for office and ultimately elected a few. Again, it was a, I used to use the term nonpartisan. It's actually multipartisan. We had people from all the parties running and eventually expanded it out, not just provincially, but municipally, federally. And, you know, it was a very successful program. Programs that other people have copied, along with our famous legislative day, the first doctor day back in the late 90s, in which now everybody does, where they bring their special interest group up to Queen's Park and spend the day meeting with people and lobbying and all that kind of stuff.
How did that experience inform your ability to write the book, though?
Well, it's funny. Before I went to work for the Ontario Medical Association, I was like most people. I thought doctors were fat cats, took Wednesdays off to play golf, drove big cars. And when I got to work at the OMA, I got to see a very different side. I got to see, basically, I talk about this in the book, in the middle section known as the Hippocratic Oath, where I really focus on sort of three aspects of doctors. But I got to see that it's really more of a calling than a job for these people. And, you know, one of the things I'm concerned about, say, doctors, nurses, and other healthcare workers, because of the special kind of people they are and the way they think, they've been going around for the last 20 years sticking their fingers in every hole in the dike trying to keep the system from collapsing. We'd been further ahead if they'd let it collapse 20 years ago, so we could have been on to trying to fix it. Because what has happened, of course, by doing that is it's given the politicians an excuse to say, oh, there's nothing wrong with the system. It's working fine. We don't have to do anything, and so on and so on and so on. So they've done us a bit of a disservice by trying to keep the thing from collapsing, but now it's going to collapse anyways.
Isn't that their Hippocratic Oath, though? I mean, they have to keep serving and looking after people. I mean, how do you square that?
Well, it's not just that. It's also the Stockholm Syndrome, or you could even say battered spouse syndrome that I talk about in the book, that there's something about the makeup of a caregiver, a doctor, nurse, whatever it might be, that means they will put up with an incredible amount of abuse. And you've certainly seen since the mid-80s, when the Canada Health Act was brought in federally in 84, and then David Peterson's outlawing of extra billing in 85, it's become almost a sport to bash doctors. And we certainly saw a great deal through the last few years of the Ontario Liberal regime. Even, as I talk about in the book, the new phenomenon of Dr. Health Minister, Dr. Eric Hoskins, was bashing his own kind, and people were taking it seriously because they figured, well, he's a doctor, he must know, you know. So it's been painful to watch the abuse doctors have taken. And again, I'm not speaking as the doctor's lobbyist. I'm just simply pointing out, as I do in the book, that we owe them a lot, as we do nurses and other healthcare providers. But, you know, the politicians will always play this game, the blame game, and you know, I sort of say it's like having a baseball bat and a pinata, and doctors are the ones they're wailing on.
So in the book, you just said it a couple of seconds ago, but in the book you spend quite a bit of time talking about the need to maybe blow up the system. You said let it collapse. That's not, if I'm laying at home and I'm not feeling well or I have a chronic condition, that's not particularly assuring information you're giving me or a plan that I would feel good about. What do you mean by that, blowing up the healthcare system?
I was visiting a couple of friends in the hospital last week, and somebody said, oh, you should bring them a copy of your book. And I said, I don't think you want to be reading this book when you're lying in a hospital bed, believe me. What I'm essentially saying here is that we need to think outside the box. One of the great problems is, you know, there's a great illustration, which I can't really do it on radio, of the, you have four dots in the shape of a square and three straight lines. Connect all the dots using the three straight lines. And most people say, I can't do it. Well, of course, the solution is for the lines to go outside the box and then down. So you actually create a triangle. So all four dots in the triangle. If you think outside the box, you don't stop yourself. But if you think inside the box, like most of us do, you'll say, well, we can't do that. And so you've seen this obsession with the Canada Health Act. And people ask me, you know, what surprised you while you're writing the book? I was shocked to discover the Canada Health Act, which everyone wraps themselves in the flag like it's some great patriotic thing. The Canada Health Act is actually a finance bill. It was actually designed to outlaw extra billing and co-payments. Other than the five principles that were five of Tommy Douglas's eight principles, they left out efficient, effective, and responsible, interestingly enough. It has nothing to do with healthcare. It's all about imposing financial penalties on provinces who allow for really innovation.
Well, you've described the healthcare system, though, as both a pit stop on the Indy 500 and also as a major snowstorm in Toronto. Can you explain how those two metaphors work?
Yeah, absolutely. I believe it was Christine Blatchford had the great line that people who have never used our healthcare system say we have the best healthcare system in the world. But then I run into people who will say, well, I had a heart attack or I had whatever it was and they saved my life and it was phenomenal healthcare system. And that's very true. When I dropped dead and I was riding in the back of the ambulance, basically saying to myself, if I actually make it to the hospital and survive this, I'm finally going to write this book after all these years. It's like pulling into the pit at Indy 500, and you have this incredible team who works together on the car, in this case, your body, and saves your life and do all the things that are needed. But if you don't have a life-threatening problem, it's very much like when you have a snowstorm in a major city like Toronto, and the main thoroughfares get plowed right away. But if you happen to live on a side street, you may not see a plow for 3 or 4 days. And that's what our healthcare system is like. You know, in comparison to America, where they ration healthcare by the size of your wallet and your credit card, here we ration healthcare by wait lists. And I'm simply saying that there's going to be a revolution. I'm basically calling for a healthcare Arab Spring in Canada. And the boomers and zoomers and those of us who are my age, I just turned 60, we're the ones that are going to drive this, because we're not going to put up with waiting, you know, months and months and months, if not years, for hips or eyes or whatever it might be. We're going to want to have the freedom to choose and spend our own money to take care of those things right now.
So you talk about this in the book as well. You talk about it being a financial bill, the Canada Health Act. You talk about our healthcare system as an insurance scheme. And you've also characterized it as a sickness system, not a wellness system. So let's unpack a bit of that. First of all, this idea of a sickness system, not a wellness system.
Yeah, part of my concern is that when you stop and think about it, we don't spend a lot of time on prevention or wellness or nutrition. I mean, I'm the poster boy for how not to eat. I remember when I had my my kidney stones and I finally had that problem taken care of after some very expensive procedures. The nutritionist said, well, how much cheese do you eat? And I told her, and she said, is that a year, a month, a week? And I said, that's a day. And she looked at me and said, I don't understand how you're not dead. That's a problem a lot of us have, is we don't eat right. We don't get enough exercise. And what's really scary is the number of obese children in the future, generations coming. It's going to get even worse. So my great concern is we have set up a system, and with the fee-for-service where doctors get paid for a fee for whatever it is they do, there's really no fees for keeping us well. Or, you know, you go to your doctor and he says, we got to stop smoking or you got to lose weight, but they never explain how you do it, because A, there isn't really a code to get paid for that, and B, they don't have time to go into that. So my great concern with our healthcare system is it really has very little to do with healthcare, and it's all about treating illness. And I think we need to change our mindset, again, think outside the box, and start taking prevention, nutrition, and wellness a lot more seriously.
Now, the Alliance for Healthier Communities has talked about social prescribing, which I understand is a system where doctors would actually prescribe exercise or prescribe yoga classes or other similar kinds of things. How do you feel about that kind of a system? Is that what you're talking about here?
Oh yeah, I'm perfectly fine with that. I'm you know, a lot of people will want to portray myself and Dr. Brian Day, who wrote the foreword for my book and who's got the Charter Challenge out in BC. They want to always throw that old canard out there that we're trying to get rid of the public system and replace it with a private system. And that's not what we're talking about at all. So I'm perfectly fine with out-of-the-box ideas that might bring these sort of social determinants of health to the table. I think, see, people will say to me, well, which country's healthcare system should we imitate? And I say, we shouldn't. We have enough smart people in Canada to create our own made-in-Canada system, and that's what we should be doing. We can certainly look at what other countries are doing. There's lots of good models in Europe and other parts of the world, but I want us to create a made-in-Canada system, and that system is going to have to seriously look at other things that affect people's health.
Now, what about this idea of a two-tier healthcare system? Because your critics are very vocal on this aspect of it, because you do say that a private healthcare system adjacent to the regular public system is the model that you think would work best. Can you first of all explain your vision there, yeah, of what you're trying to achieve?
Well, first of all, the go-to for these other groups that are against us is always, you want to replace Canada's system with a U.S.-style two-tier system. So Canada, of OECD countries, is currently ranked 30th. The U.S. is ranked 36th. Why would we want to replace the 30th place system with number 36? That, first of all, is ludicrous. Number two, a two-tier system would actually be a huge improvement because we currently have about a 10 to 15-tier system. We have the workers' compensation tier, we have the RCMP tier, the Friends of Doctors tier, the hockey players tier, and most upsetting to most Canadians when they discover it is the prisoners tier. Those in Canadians' jail have better access to health care than the rest of us, which if that doesn't make your blood boil, nothing will.
How does that work, just so that people understand what you're
referring to? Well, for example, with workers' compensation, the idea is we're going to jump the queue and get these guys to a doctor or to an MRI quickly, because the quicker we can get them back to work, it's going to save us having to pay them on workers' comp. So these different tiers that exist right now have been set up under different circumstances, different pieces of legislation, whatever it might be, historically over the years. So I guess in the case of prisoners, if there's something wrong with a prisoner, they want to get them treated as fast as possible to get them back in jail. And, you know, all of these things are, what I'm talking about really is accounting, not just finance, but accounting. There's a bunch of numbers here that don't add up. But bottom line is, we need a hybrid solution. Canada is the only country in the world that doesn't allow for choice. And if you can spend money, talk about medical savings accounts. If you can put money away to buy a big screen TV or buy a carton of cigarettes or a bottle of booze, why can't you put money away to pay for your health care, whether you want to speed up getting your knee surgery or whether you maybe have some catastrophic illness happen where something isn't covered? I talk about the situation here in Ontario where the two options were pay $3,000 for an operation for the boy who was having corneal problems with his eyes, or let him go blind, and then at that point, under OHIP, again, the insurance system, the insurance scheme, we can actually cover, once he's gone blind, that treatment. Well, I mean, that's just bizarre. How do you have a system like that?
But if you look at it, let's take the example of senior care, because I think that seems to be a good parallel or a micro example of what you're talking about. Now, you know, if my health's fine and I have a few problems, I can get home care. They come in, they help give me assistance, and that's fine. But if there's all of a sudden a change, something I didn't expect, and now all of a sudden I have to look at maybe going into assisted living, but I'm only receiving maybe old age pension and maybe a supplement to that. Maybe I have a very tiny pension that I've been living off of for maybe 20 or 30 years that has not increased with the inflation. All of a sudden, I don't really have the monetary resources. That's not through no fault of my mm-hmm. own. And suddenly, I have nowhere to go.
Yeah.
You know, because the local municipal site is full. I can't afford $5,000. I mean, it's $3,000 to $5,000 a month, here just in Northumberland for that kind of care. The system you're talking about, great. If I have an insurance plan, I have a good job full time, they help cover my benefits, I'm golden. But if I'm, you know, self-employed or I'm working precariously, your proposal is a very frightening one.
Yeah, and that's why you have a bunch of things built into it. For example, doctors that are going to participate in the private system have to work X number of hours per month in the public system in order to work in the private system. In the case of paying for various things, whatever it might be, you have a means test. So if you're over a certain age, if you're making a certain amount of money, you're not over, say, $30,000, whatever it might be, we can build all these things into the system. So this is not a system that's meant for the rich to benefit at the benefit of the poor. You know, right now, Tommy Douglas was all about making sure people didn't lose their homes and go bankrupt and all that sort of stuff. He still felt that there was value in people making some kind of financial contribution to their health care. Now, he didn't necessarily spell out user fees or co-payments. But bottom line is, I think Tommy Douglas would be unhappy with our current system because many of the people most suffering under our current system are the poor, the vulnerable, and the aged.
But don't we contribute through our taxes? I mean, why should we have to contribute above our taxes? I mean, that is our contribution.
Well, again, it's an accounting problem. So let me just talk about that for a minute. So us boomers, there's a study I talk about in the book, us boomers are going to receive $4,000 more health care than we pay in our taxes. The millennials coming behind us will pay $18,000 more in taxes than healthcare received, and the iGens behind them will pay $27,000 more in taxes than healthcare received, because it's an illusion that we're paying for our own healthcare. We're actually paying for the generation ahead of us or behind us or however you want to look at it, like our parents. We're all paying for our parents' healthcare, basically. And so the problem is, once you get to the millennials and iGens, the whole thing collapses like a big pyramid scheme, like a Ponzi scheme. And that's why we have to do something about it now.
We're going to hear a lot more about this and obviously continue our conversation, but we're going to take a break for some commercials. I'm talking to Stephen Skivington, author of the new book, This May Hurt a Bit, The Reinventing of Canada's Healthcare System. Please stay tuned to consider this on Northumberland 89.7 FM, your truly local source for news. We'll be right back. Hello and welcome back. This is Consider This Northumberland, and I'm your host, Robert Washburn, and you're listening to Northumberland 89.7 FM. Stephen Skivington, author, is my guest, and he is author of a new book, This May Hurt a Bit, Reinventing Canada's Healthcare System. And before we get into our conversation, I understand you have some dates coming up that for people who might be interested in learning more or hearing more about what you're doing.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm setting up, I think it's mostly book signings, although if people want me to read, or I certainly engage in discussions, I'm happy to do that. So the first one is at the Belleville Indigo on 390 North Front Street, which is basically the Quinty Mall, for those of you who know. Sunday, March the 10th, that would be this Sunday, from 12 noon to 3 o'clock, I'll be there. If you'd like me to scrawl my signature and ruin the front of your book, happy to do it. Saturday, March 23rd, 4 o'clock till 6 o'clock at the Peterborough Chapters, 873 Lansdowne Street West. Oshawa will be doing a big event at the Indigo at the Oshawa Center, the mall, the following week on Saturday, March 30th from 3 o'clock till 5 o'clock. And then for those in Cobourg, Furby Books, the Port Hope Bookstore, is going to be sponsoring an event at the Cobourg Public Library, 200 Ontario Street, of course, in Cobourg, Saturday, June 8th, 2:30 till 4:30. I would look forward to having you come out, and I'm pretty sure at the library I'll be able to do a reading and have quite a nice little chat, and I believe we'll have books there to for you to buy, and I'll sign them and all that kind of good stuff. I know the libraries have ordered up copies, I just don't know how many, so...
Okay, that's great. So you've got those dates and places. If you're interested in getting a copy of the book and having Steve sign it and also talk to him about what he's proposing, there's a great opportunity. In the book, at the end, you talk about the big fix. And we've talked a bit about some of the problems that you see with the healthcare system. And we started to talk about your proposal for a two-tier healthcare system. In the big fix, you give 10 things that the people in charge could do tomorrow to reinvent and ultimately to fix Canada's healthcare system. I'm going to read the list out, and then I'd like to go back and let's unpack it. So the first thing you say is stop lying to us. The second thing is put patients first, ideology second. The third is revise Canada Healthcare Act. so that quality becomes the sixth principle. The fourth thing is combine all of Canada's provincial and territorial health ministries into one federal super ministry with one health minister. And the next is stop focusing on illness and figure out how to keep us healthy instead. And the sixth is open the door to medical tourism. Seven is invest heavily in long-term care and be prepared to face the consequences. Eight is bring back co-payments and user fees and introduce tax-free medical savings accounts. Nine is for Canadians to pay for services we want by introducing a parallel private healthcare system and allow it to operate above board, the so-called hybrid solution. And 10 is fund it or free it. So let's go back and let's look at each one of those. So what's this business about stop lying to us? Are people lying to us? I thought they're telling us what's going to be good for us.
Yeah, there's a lot of lying going on. First, I should probably say that in case people thought I just came up with these ideas after a night of drinking, I went down to Burlington, Dr. Min Bassiter's place, and he's got this Simplexity system. So we had three three-hour sessions in which we did a lot of, basically you sort of create charts on the wall and yellow stickies and arrows going all over the place. So we figured out how you would go about doing this. And then I took that map and put it up on my wall as I wrote the book. And the book actually follows that model quite nicely, the original model we did 2 or 3 years ago. So in the case of stop lying to us, and I've just actually written a piece that's going to be in the Globe and Mail in the next week called The Fear Factor. Politicians are so afraid. They're motivated by fear. And so what's happening is no one's willing to tell the truth and admit the truth, admit that we have a huge accounting problem. And, you know, case in point, when the draft legislation for Ontario, this new super agency, got leaked by the NDP, the first thing Premier Ford did was have his health minister, Christine Elliott, he trotted her out to say, no, we're not doing private care. No, we're not doing this. We're not doing that. And they have to. I mean, like, just admit it. Tell the truth. Tell what has to be done. So my great concern with this is that I'm calling politicians out. I mean, because, you know, in the same way it takes a thief to catch a thief, I'm a pretty good, pretty famous spin doctor. I know how to tell professional lies. I know how to change the channel. All the things that our prime minister should be doing and is, at the moment is doing quite badly on the SNC-Lavalin affair. So I'm able to point out when we're being lied to, and I do it throughout the book. And if we're ever going to have that adult conversation everyone keeps talking about, and my goal with this book is to spend the next 8 or 10 months talking about healthcare and making it the number one issue in the run-up to the October 21st federal election, if we're going to have an adult conversation, we can't be playing this game of let's pretend anymore. We have to talk the truth. And so I say the book is the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, because unlike Jack Nicholson, I believe Canadians can handle the truth.
But there must be, I mean, you've been around politics long enough that there are multiple truths. And I mean, you know, you could talk to the Ontario Healthcare Coalition and they would tell you that the truth is we need to have a better public system and forget this two-tier system. And they would believe that they were telling us the truth. And I believe in all sincerity, you're sitting here across from me today and you're trying to tell me your truth. So as somebody who's sitting, you know, maybe a listener sitting at home right now and I'm going, wait a minute, whose truth do I believe? Why is your solution the truth and not what the Ontario Health Coalition is?
Well, let me give you a couple of examples. So Dr. Daniel Martin and the Canadian Doctors for Medicare, which is another group very much like the Ontario Health Coalition, they went to Unifor, the big 300,000-member union, Canada's biggest union. You certainly have seen them in the news with the GM closings. And they asked for $24,000 to pay their legal bills to have intervener status in Dr. Day's charter challenge out in BC, and the union gave them $50,000. I'm getting nothing from anybody. I don't have backers. I don't have, like, some private health care. I don't have the Cleveland Clinic writing me checks. A lot of these groups are, whether it's union, NDP, or whoever's special interest, as like my dad used to say, it all depends on whose ox is being gored. Whoever is worried, like, for example, private health care will introduce competition, and then so unions are worried, well, is that going to cost us jobs? Is that going to cost us money? You know, so they've got a horse in the race. But here's something that's disgusting to me, and again, going to Dr. Day's charter challenge out in BC. Dr. Day raises $2 million, mortgages his clinics, gets individual Canadians sending in checks, okay? The government of BC in the first 6 months has 20 lawyers. They spend $20 million on those 20 lawyers to try to keep people on wait lists and dying on wait lists. That's what the fight is about there. I believe that number is now up to $30 million. And by the way, this is taxpayer dollars. These are dollars being paid by British Columbia taxpayers, okay, to pay for all this. And then they try and pass a piece of legislation that nobody will know how much they actually spent. I mean, this is the way government operates. They do nefarious things and then they try to hide it. And as I say, we're seeing it right now with the various scandals going on federally that have nothing to do with healthcare. But my concern is that, when you shine a light in a darkened room on the cockroaches and they start scattering, I'm trying to shine a light here. I know where the bodies are buried. I know what lies are being told. And I've tried to do with this book is to share for the average Canadian in a way, in a very conversational style. This is not a stodgy health policy book. I'm trying to share what I know from the back rooms that I've worked in. I can tell you that almost every politician I've ever encountered when we're having a drink or a meal will admit that we have to go to the hybrid system, that we cannot, our current system is unsustainable, the status quo is not an option. But they won't admit it in public, they won't admit it at a photo op, they won't admit it at a press conference, and that's the problem.
So what does that mean in terms of your second point, which is to put patients first and ideology second?
Well, first of all this lefting and righting, right wing, left wing, and back and forth, I mean, it's like enough to give you a whiplash. It's really important when you look at announcements that get made that we solve the real problem and not the political problem. And let me give you an example of that. So again, not to pick on Doug Ford, but he's the most recent example of this. So hallway medicine, we're going to fix hallway medicine. So you've got all of these patients lined up on gurneys like planes waiting to take off on the tarmac, and we call them bed blockers, which is a horrible term. I call them human beings. So they did a study. Now, before I get to the study, Ford's solution is I'm going to throw money at the hospital. They're going to open more hospital beds, and that's going to fix the problem. Well, no, that's fixing the political problem. If you're going to fix the problem, and again, getting back to Dr. Min Bassett's simplexity system, we often end up with a fuzzy situation masquerading as a problem that really isn't the problem. So here's the problem you really need to fix to end hallway healthcare. Not throwing money at hospitals to open more beds, but they did a study in Hamilton. They discovered that 40% of the bed blocking was being done by 9% of the bed blocking patients. And when they dug deeper, they discovered that those patients suffered from extreme dementia, were obese, had a series of problems. You know, you think about personal support workers trying to lift obese patients when they don't have the proper machinery, blows out their backs and knees. Nursing homes are not set up to deal with dementia, so they end up just basically tranquilizing the patients. So what we really need to solve the problem is to fix our home care nursing home situation and get the right kind of tools in there and the right kind of services. That's how you fix the real problem. So that's what I mean about getting past ideology and putting patients first. We have a system that puts patients last. Whether you're talking about fee-for-service, how we bill, whether you're talking about waiting lists, whether you're talking about the lack of choice, I am very big on putting patients first because, and this is why I'm calling for a healthcare revolution, we own the system. It's not owned by the politicians. It's not owned by the civil servants. It's not owned by special interest groups. We own the system. We pay for it. We should have the choice to do what we want in this system, to pay for the things we want to pay for, and to move things along more quickly without all this ideology, wrap yourself in the flag of the Canada Health Act BS.
Well, but, I mean, you're a political pundit. You know politics in the back room as well as anybody. And you know that what politicians are most interested is winning the next election. Mm-hmm. So if that's their motivation, what's going to inspire them or even motivate them remotely to change their agenda as we're seeing in Ontario right now, promise kept. Mm-hmm. So, we're going to liberate 23,000 kids off the waiting list for autism. And look what we're going to do. And yet you've got parents, absolutely beside themselves because they're going to lose funding and their children are not going to get the services that they need. So as a political operative, how do you square that circle?
Yeah, well, two things. Number one is I know for a fact that Ontario has commissioned a bunch of white papers, the Ministry of Health, to try and figure out how they can bring in the hybrid system without taking the blame for it. I mean, ultimately, the courts are going to decide this. Dr. Day will win his charter challenge, and then that'll go to the Supreme Court of Canada, and he'll win there. So in 10 years, this will happen anyways. But the other thing that eventually someone's going to clue into, I've seen internal and external polls that show 75% of Canadians are on side with this, or on side with the hybrid solution, or on side with having choice and being able to pay for things they want. At some point, some party, some leader is going to figure this out and say, hey, we can win a landslide in the next election if we come out and tell the truth and say, here's what we have to do. Because, you know, one of the things I talk about, and Dalton McGuinty's got that great line that there'll come a day where we can only afford the Ministry of Health and we still won't be able to afford the Ministry of Health. Unless you're willing to have every road a toll road, every school a private school, have no money for infrastructure, have no money for government services, because by 2030, in 11 years, most estimates will be spending 100% of the budget on health care. So the best way to end up with your U.S.-style two-tier system is by trying to prop this unsustainable system up and convince people, and really con people, that this is doable, because it most certainly isn't.
Well, some might say too, though, but if some people started paying their fair share of taxes, maybe we wouldn't be so underfunded and we could have the resources to go. So again, it comes back to an ideology about, you know, how do we feel about who pays taxes and how much taxes we pay, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, the problem is, again, it's a numbers game. As I was saying earlier about the boomers, there's too many boomers, not enough millennials, not enough iGens. The iGens and millennials earn too much debt from school. They have part-time jobs instead of full-time jobs. They're living in their parents' basement. They're not building equity in buying a house. And they're the ones that are going to be paying ridiculous amounts of money because there's not enough of them. Too many of us, not enough of them. This is where it collapses. These are numbers. And by the way, we haven't even talked yet about the three healthcare tsunamis, obesity, diabetes, and dementia. Any one of those three has the ability to bankrupt the country. We have no dementia strategy in this country. Diabetes is actually killing more people than AIDS or bird flu, all the things we sort of hear about all the time. And then the obesity epidemic, especially amongst children, these tsunamis are going to just wipe us out. And we, as I say, we haven't even talked in any kind of detail about that. So forget the current accounting problem. It's about to get way worse.
Well, the fourth fix you suggest is to combine all of Canada's provincial and territorial health ministries into one federal super ministry with one health minister. This must light every provincial minister's hair on fire, because, of course, this, you know, you're going to take power away from the provinces. I mean, we almost had the country fracture the last time we started talking about trying to do anything where we shifted power up rather than leave it way, the way it was. Why do you suggest this, and how do you think it's going to happen?
Well, you'd have to have a constitutional conference. You'd have to change the constitution, because right now the feds fund it and the provinces get to run it. We have 14 healthcare ministries in this country. We have 10 provincial, 3 territorial, and 1 federal. And we have a gazillion bureaucrats, many of whom are not doing frontline care. I'm not saying you can't have some civil servants, that some people don't have to actually run the system. But we have way too many. You know, I did a study. I talked about this. I was trying to find out how many employees there were at the Ontario Ministry of Health. And so we got 2 phone books from, I think it was 01 and 06. And the number of phone extensions in the phone book doubled in those 5 years. Now, we're assuming that every employee has their own phone extension. So that means the numbers doubled. And when I look at LHINs, for example, the integrated health networks that are, I mean, I hope to God Christine Elliott is actually going to be firing a bunch of people, because that was like a landing spot for liberal hacks, as happens every time whoever the government is, they end up dropping their friends into these kind of jobs. But we have all kinds of efficiencies that could come out of this. But yeah, you're right. There's going to be a great pushback against this, and the provinces would want something if they're going to give something up. So men and women of goodwill can make this happen. The question is, will it happen? It'll only happen if we push for it. So it's up to us, really. And that's the whole point of the book, is to educate the people so that they understand what we're up against here.
Why do you advocate for medical tourism? That seems sort of an outlier in all of the things that you talk about. And then you throw this thing in about bringing people from the outside in to use our services. Well, we can't even get our services to work for us. Why would we want people coming in from outside?
Well, I believe healthcare shouldn't just be a cost center. It should be a revenue generator. And one of the things people don't know, our surgeons only operate one day a week, not because there's not enough surgeons, not because there's not a demand for it. It's that we don't have the money to run the operating room the other 4 days of the week, whether it's keeping the lights on, paying for the nurses, or whatever it might be. So I'm saying that this would be helpful for a variety of reasons. Is you will get our surgeons working more days a week, along with the other healthcare professionals. You'll be bringing money not only to the healthcare system, which can actually then be used in the public system. We can, of course, have a percentage of the private money being paid by outsiders go to our public system. But it would also help the hospitality industry. Instead of, you know, you look at countries like India and various places around the world, Mexico, where they built a whole hospitality industry around people going for various types of operations and procedures. So I believe that, you know, instead of simply costing us money, and we had over 60,000 people leave Canada for procedures outside of Canada, I guess it was 2 years ago, that the Fraser Institute found. So I believe that medical tourism has to be an important part of this out-of-the-box thinking.
But, I mean, our own hospital here, we know that there are closed beds because they don't have enough funding. I think there's an entire wing that is not used. Why don't we just, you know, pay more money, open these beds, pay more money, get the surgeons to use the system and have our own people be using the system to its full extent that it was designed for rather than bringing people in from outside?
Because Mike Harris, in 1995, ran on a platform of being the tax cutter. And ever since then, it's speaking of third rails, if you run and say you're going to raise taxes, even if you say, I'm going to raise taxes to pay for more health care to open beds, you won't win the election. We have now had like 23 years of this mentality that you cannot raise taxes. And so that's why that won't happen. The only way you could do it is by raising taxes or looking at some of the creative solutions I'm suggesting.
Earlier this week, I'm sorry we didn't get to all 10, but we're kind of running out of time, and I have one thing I wanted to talk to you about locally. So earlier this week, there was a partnership between Northumberland Hills Hospital, Community Mental Health Services, and the Rebound Child and Youth Services and Northumberland Community Counseling Center opened a youth walk-in clinic. What did you think of that in the context of what you've been writing about, what you've been talking about?
Well, again, you know, as I just appeared on the agenda with Steve Paikin, and some of the other people at the table had a variety of ideas of how we might go about doing things. I'm fine, and this is what I was getting at earlier, that I think we've got so much talent here and so many smart people. Like, I don't have to have all the ideas in one book. I'm fine with having people suggest these things, try these things, and see what might work. Part of our problem in Canada is if somebody comes up with an innovation in one province, there's no way of kind of having it picked up somewhere else. And I liken it to, see, the way it's set up is, you know, you've got the feds funding it. It's a voluntary system, believe it or not. Our Medicare is voluntary, but the provinces get dinged money if they try to allow extra billing or whatever it might be. But I liken it to hockey. So we have a system right now where imagine Montreal and Toronto played three 20-minute periods hockey game. Let's say Ottawa, Winnipeg, Edmonton played two 30-minute hockey periods in hockey. And Vancouver and Calgary played one 60-minute period. So hockey fans would never put up with that. That's nuts. But that's where our healthcare is designed. It's all these different fiefdoms, and there's really no ability to share creative ideas. So I really want a system, and this is why I'm suggesting we should have one federal super ministry to oversee this so that good ideas can be shared and out-of-the-box thinking can go Canada-wide.
There's so much in your book. And so much to cover, and unfortunately, we run out of time. What's next steps for you?
Well, one of the things I'm looking for is supporters, backers. I'd like to create a Institute of Healthcare Reform and Innovation. I'm not really, at this point, envisioning a bricks-and-mortar kind of a place, but if there are any sort of CEOs or Dragon Den types, angels, people who are fine to invest their time and money and support behind the idea of creating such an institute where we could bring in people and creative people. I could certainly go out and speak on this. I've joined up a couple of speakers bureaus, so you're going to be hearing a lot from me. I'm going to be speaking in July to the ProBiz Club at Coburg. Watch, again, if you follow me on Twitter at S. Skivington, Facebook page, Stephen Skivington, or if you want to send me an email at Politrain, PolitraiN, at simpatico.ca. I'm all over social media. There's lots of ways to get a hold of me. I'm very easy to find. And I'm looking for people who are creative and want to, you know, bring their expertise to the table, because I really think we need an institute that can talk about healthcare reform and innovation. And the last thing I'm going to be doing, I'm really excited about, on the 27th of September, we're going down to Concordia University in Montreal for a one-day workshop. We're going to take my 10 points in the Big Fix and actually figure out how to make them work all in one day. And people, it's not just for students. Anybody can go to their website, find the course, and join up and come and join us. So I encourage you, if you want to be a part of this, sign up and be part of that course.
Absolutely fascinating. Well, I hope as things unfold in the upcoming days and months that we can get you to come back as things change and things evolve, and you can provide us with some more insight. Thank you so much for being here, Stephen.
Oh, it was my pleasure.
This has been the first in a series of interviews that I'm doing over the next few weeks, looking at healthcare services in Northumberland in light of the Ontario government's plans to overhaul the system. Last week, we looked at the impact of the changes to funding and with children's autism. And next week, we are going to have Linda Davis, the CEO of Northumberland Hills Hospital, on the show. We're going to talk to her about these proposed changes and how they might affect NHH. But we'll also be talking to her, obviously, about some of the things we've interviewed Stephen about today. There's a lot going on here, so we have plenty to talk about. And at the end, I'm hoping to get our MPP, David Pacini, to come in and help shed some light on what the government is doing and maybe help us better understand what the direction they're taking. So I hope you'll continue to join me each week over the upcoming weeks as we work our way through these complex issues. If you have any comments, questions, rants, or raves, please email me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can go to my Facebook page, Consider This. Or if you're on Twitter, you can message me at rwash. I will read out a selection of comments on next week's show. If you like to listen to this broadcast again, or share any podcast that we do here, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your busy day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this, Northumberland.